You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 213 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures, entitled Human Questions and Cosmic Answers, translated by Elizabeth Marshall. This is Lecture 8, given in Dornach on the 9th of July, 1922. This time I want to use a personal example to show how what we now call anthroposophy had to grow out of intellectual life as a whole. It is a valid argument to say that when we discuss such things, we are only speaking to a small circle of people. We look at individual human beings who are interested in scientific, philosophic, or other pursuits, and are unknown to most people, and so we position ourselves outside what is important for the great mass of humanity. However, you just need to take a more impartial look, and you will see that this view is not tenable. You only have to consider that what lives in most people as soul content, as the impulse to act or not to act, stems from the influence of leading personalities, even though they may have no knowledge of what people, such as the ones we have considered, have experienced in their inner lives. But we must bear in mind that it is in exactly such a personality that the age, with its ideas and sensibilities, pulsates. So that at least a large number of those people who pursue a higher education learn about what such persons experience and carry it with them into those places where the leaders of humanity, who influence the greater masses of humankind, are educated. Thus, what we can observe as the intimate experiences of such a personality can become an impulse which then permeates into the lives of the greater mass of people. It is just that the channels through which these intellectual impulses flow into the greater mass of people remain invisible. So, we can only look at what really and truly lives in the culture of the times, in the way we have done in the last few days, and we are justified in saying that out of the deepest spiritual experience of the 19th century, something like anthroposophy had to develop, because the culture of the times had crushed the human soul, as we have seen in the example of Franz Brentano. To achieve what I set out to do with these observations, to make them more universal, I would now like to broaden the discussion. We find Franz Brentano as a devout Catholic, a teacher of philosophy in Würzburg. After what I explained in the last 2 days, we have an idea of the content of the lectures Franz Brentano gave at his lectern in Würzburg. He tried to substantiate his arguments through reasoning, but behind this, there was all he had absorbed as a believer in Catholic theology. Some extremely important ideas appeared here. For example, Franz Brentano knew about the latest scientific theory of evolution, which was based on the notion that the human brain is similar to the brains of the higher apes. The purely naturalistic theory of evolution drew from this observation the conclusion that human beings were related to the higher mammals. Franz Brentano accepted this proposition, just as he always accepted the claims of natural science. He said that now science can show that the human brain is not very different from that of an anthropoid. However, if we look at the soul life of a human being and the soul life of an anthropoid, then we find a huge difference. The main difference is that even the highest of the ape species are unable to develop abstract concepts. Human beings can develop abstract concepts. If the human brain is similar to the brain of the ape, then according to Franz Brentano, we have to say that the thoughts that humans are capable of developing cannot originate in the brain, because otherwise they would also originate in the brain of the ape. Hence we have to conclude that humans have something like a special soul substance, where thoughts which an anthropoid cannot develop originate. So, from scientific knowledge, Franz Brentano could deduct the existence of an independent soul substance. This was in the years 1866 to 1870, when he was teaching philosophy in Würzburg, because in the background of what he was developing philosophically, there was still the whole Catholic theological worldview. However, Franz Brentano later left Catholic theology behind and immersed himself in his own individual point of view, which first had had to be informed by Catholic theology. He came increasingly to a purely scientific understanding of soul phenomena and lost sight of this soul substance, could no longer stand by this soul substance. Quite simply, his cognitive faculty weakened when he tried to reach up to a level beyond the mere association and separation of ideas about the internal life of the soul itself. Now, as I have already mentioned, this scientific way of thinking is just a direct continuation of scholastic thinking, despite the fact that some of its proponents object to this view. Scholastic thinking said that revelation deals with the supersensible world, so that only the world of the senses, together with conclusions drawn from it through sense observation, can be the object of human cognition. And what was so important to the scholastics, on the one hand, what was only accessible to sense perception as scientific knowledge, and on the other, what existed as knowledge of the supersensible world through revelation, this developed in the course of the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries into the stance that natural phenomena would be studied according to the principles developed by the scholastics, and that for science the teaching of revelations would be abandoned. Therefore, we can see modern science as a legitimate child of medieval scholasticism, in the sense I have described here. And so it should be no surprise for us to see that people hold on to revelation, as did Franz Brentano in his youth, and as Catholic scholars still do today, who accept a science limited to the world of the senses, and hold that we should not attempt to gain knowledge of the supersensible, which remains accessible only through revelation. So we can imagine that scientists and Catholic theologians can work together in one institution without any dispute arising about the area of influence of the Catholic theologist and that of the scientist. Here I would like to offer you an example. Let us look at how Franz Brentano taught logic, metaphysics, ethics, and the history of philosophy in Würzburg from 1867 to 1870. So as to make this as vivid as possible, I will stay in one place, in Würzburg, and ask you to envision Brentano's auditorium around the year 1869, where he lectured on subjects as described above, where he spoke about the similarities in the brains of humans and the higher apes, and how there must be a soul substance which brings forth thinking in human beings. Now, let us take another chapter, which he also lectured on at that time, on the existence of God, on the proofs of the existence of God. There, in his usual astute manner, he offered all that human reason can bring forth to prove the existence of God, and of course he pointed out that with human cognition we can only approach the existence of God, but the final truth of the matter has to be given through revelation. Now, let us imagine how in front of a large audience Franz Brentano lectured on his metaphysics, his philosophy, in a Catholic sense, but with great regard for science. How he approached the deepest problems of humanity in this fashion. Now let us go from Brentano's auditorium in the university in Würzburg to that of the physiologist Adolf Fick. At the same time as Franz Brentano was lecturing in metaphysics and philosophy in Würzburg, Adolf Fick was lecturing there on physiology. Now I would like you to imagine what a listener in Adolf Fick's auditorium would have heard, a listener who perhaps had listened to Franz Brentano's philosophy, as I have described to you. I only need to mention it, as what I want to show you is all preserved in the lectures that Adolf Fick held at the University of Würzburg at that time. What he said can be summarized in the following sentences. we look, for example, at the warmth that we notice at first through sensation. When we touch a body, it will seem warm or cold. We have sensations of warmth. What these sensations of warmth correspond to in the outside world is the movement of the smallest parts of the body, the movement that takes place in atoms and molecules, or by atoms and molecules in space. If, for example, we look at a gas, then this gas has to be in an enclosed space. In there we find the atoms and molecules of the specific gas. However, they are not in a resting state. They are swimming here and there, bouncing against each other, bouncing off the walls. In there, it is all movement and uproar, and there's a diagram. And if we touch this, which inside is all movement, with the surface of our skin, then we have the sensation of warmth. This was the general view in science at the time, the view that developed particularly out of the teachings of Julius Robert Meyer, and from what Helmholtz, Clausius, and other scientific thinkers at the times had achieved. Joule, the English brewer, who was also a scientific researcher, had discovered that through a movement, for example, that of a paddle wheel moving in water, the water can become warm. We could then measure how much work the paddle wheel does and how much warmth develops. And we could then assert that through movement, through mechanical work done, warmth develops. This is nothing less than the conversion of what the paddle wheel, moving in water, produces in visible movement. It converts into movements that are invisible, but can be perceived as warmth. Hence warmth was considered to be a form of movement. Now at the time, they had also discovered that not only warmth is converted into movement, but that other forces of nature can be converted into movement as well. So a physiologist, such as Adolf Fick, could proclaim that all forces of nature, magnetism, electricity, chemical forces, can be converted, that one can be converted into the other, and that basically the only difference between them consists of the fact that we perceive the various forms of movement in different ways with our senses. So if we disregard what we have in us as warmth sensations, light sensations, and so on, and look just at what is outside us in space, then there is only movement everywhere. The physiologist continues his observations by saying that when we look at our body, the most highly developed organism, and Adolf Fick now comes into his own field of physiology, we cannot assume there is a special life force which makes the molecules of this organism move about in this way, but rather what moves around outside when we feel warmth, some kind of tension force, electricity or magnetism. This is also at work in the human body. Now, he discusses how in the human body, through the absorption of oxygen, carbon is metabolized to carbon dioxide, hydrogen to water, and thus by absorbing oxygen, combustion processes take place within the human body. He then explains that we can determine how a certain amount of oxygen is absorbed, and how a person then gives off warmth. Back then, there had already been trials with the calorimeter, measuring how much warmth is emitted by one animal or another, and some tests were also made on humans, which showed that this whole thing was wrong. However, it was said that mistakes had been made in the experiments, but that despite that, they had found data which showed that what corresponded to the absorption of a certain amount of oxygen was then emitted as warmth. They assumed that part of what was processed internally went into the movement of the muscles, so that effectively the warmth that developed in the human being through the burning of carbon to carbon dioxide or of hydrogen to water produced these movements. The human being breathes in oxygen. Hydrogen burns down to water, carbon to carbon dioxide. What makes a person warm inside, what they then emit, is only the movement of their smallest parts. Only after the conversion of these forces do these parts convert to what forms the basis for the movement of the muscles, when the person does not only give off heat, but also works with their muscles, or even just moves their limbs. Therefore, we can say that the human being is, in the main, a complicated physical-chemical organization, which through breathing in oxygen emits heat and performs work. Adolf Fick went on in this vein, saying that when, however, humans continually breathe in oxygen and use it up through combustion, then in the historical development of the earth, we should have noticed that there is now less oxygen. However, this is not the case. We could explain this by the fact that oxygen is continually being produced. The sun shines on the plants, and when they absorb sunshine, they give off oxygen. Thus, oxygen becomes available. Humans can breathe it in again. The oxygen that humans and animals need is produced by the plant world. In his lectures, Adolf Fick continues, "By continually emitting light and heat, the sun at least must be getting colder." He then shows how we can calculate how much cooler the sun should become. Julius Robert Meyer had done this before him and had shown that the sun should really have cooled down completely, and that according to the amount it gives off, it really should not be able to emit heat anymore at all. Therefore, Julius Robert Meyer assumed, and Fick submitted this in his lectures, that comet masses, which according to Kepler must be more numerous in space than there are fish in the sea, are continually plunging into the sun. When something plunges into a body, new warmth is created. Through this continual plunging in of comets, the warmth of the sun, and with it the sunlight, is constantly created anew. There was only a bit of a dilemma, as Adolf Fick assured his listeners, because we would have to assume that these comet masses were always there. Therefore, we would have to assume that the masses which fly into the sun are then thrown out again, so that they can fly back in again. Here, too, he found a way out by showing that according to the second principle of the mechanical theory of heat, it is not necessary for the heat of the sun to exist continuously, since it is a law of development that we can prove with the strictest logic. At the time Clausius had published the second principle of the mechanical theory of heat, that through conversion, forces are continually converted into heat, but that heat cannot convert itself back into forces, so that heat is always left over. This means that in the end, all events in the world must be transformed into heat states which level themselves out. Then nothing will be left of all that has happened in the world but the so-called heat death. In the end, everything will culminate in this so-called heat death. Thus Adolf Fick put forward how the earth, with all that takes place upon it, including human life, is moving toward this heat death, how all will find its end eventually in this heat death, a strictly physical view of the world. We can imagine how Adolf Fick, the physiologist, was presenting this teaching as the worldview of physics, while Brentano, in his own lecture hall across the way, presented what I described to you earlier. Now, I would like to tell you about how these two finished their lectures. Let us assume that Brentano closed his lecture as follows. When we look at the scientific view of the evolution of the world, then we have to postulate an initial state which natural science can recognize. We arrive at a final state, which today even science characterizes as heat death. However, all this is illuminated and ensouled by divine spiritual processes. We are guided to a beginning where a creative act of God brings to life all that science can study today. Then we arrive at the heat death, out of which only a creative act of God can further guide our evolution. Franz Brentano could have said something like this at the end of one of his lectures, and he did say it. Let us assume that the two lectures were held one after the other, not simultaneously, so that after listening to Franz Brentano, a student could have gone across to Adolf Fick and listened to the last lecture about physiology. What would they have heard there? Now, I am quoting. I'm only saying what Adolf Fick said himself at that time, about 1869, at the same university where Brentano taught. After he had made the remarks I have described above in several previous lectures, he said, "We will arrive at that point where all events, both around us and in us, will go into the heat death, meaning the end of the world. When, however, according to all the rules of science, we can assume such an end to the world, when we have forgotten nothing, when we have to postulate such an end according to the strictest science, then we cannot suppose otherwise than that there was a beginning to the world. For it is inconceivable that a world with all its scientific processes that has existed since eternity has not long suffered the heat death. Since this heat death will only develop after some time, the world must have begun at some point. So that according to Adolf Fick, it must have begun through a creative act of God." So you could hear in the one auditorium Catholic theological philosophy from Franz Brentano, with the conclusion I have just described to you, and then go across to the physiologist, not, however, to someone like Vogt and others, who could not think things through consequently, but a physiologist who could, and he said the same on the basis of natural science. This is an extremely interesting fact. It means that when scientists only went as far as pointing out a creative act of God, then they were in line with what could be heard in the next lecture hall on the basis of Catholic theology. What could a listener do who had heard about the physical constitution of the world, and that it could even be proved that its beginning was a creative act of God? Adolf Fick would have said to him, "If you want to know something about this act of God, then go over to the auditorium where Catholic theology is taught." At least this is what students must have thought. And now imagine the soul of Franz Brentano. At that time it was still possible for him, with his scientific ethos, to come to such a conclusion, because what seemed to him proven about the supersensible worlds came from Catholic theology. 10 years later this was no longer possible. As I described already, 10 years later he could not fully accept the Catholic teachings of Revelation as a basis for the supersensible world. In other words, this means that when the student of science then went across to hear the continuance which science itself demanded, the lecturer, who could no longer hold on to the old tradition of Revelation, had nothing to say to them. This was, basically, already the case when Franz Brentano was lecturing in Vienna. At the time he had just left the church. In 1874 he came to Vienna. He had only left the church completely in 1873. Even though he had fallen out with the Church since the dogma of infallibility. He was so attached to the Catholic Church that it took him years to consider the matter carefully. Now, we are no longer able to imagine that from the lecture hall of Adolf Fick in Würzburg, or of Brücke in Vienna, or of some other physiologist, they would, of course, all say the same, a student could go across to Franz Brentano, and, as was possible in the 1860s, find the appropriate continuance. In Franz Brentano's lectures, they could hear stimulating and interesting ideas about ethics and about psychological problems, but nowhere was Brentano able to move from direct perception to the supersensible. This example shows clearly how if you refused to return to the old faith in Revelations, the possibility of reaching the spiritual on the basis of established intellectual culture was disappearing. This is the most important spiritual fact of our modern age. For it is the atmosphere which grew out of this that has brought forth our leading thinkers, and through their influence we have landed in a great cultural chaos of our times. Now I would like to show you the problem from another point of view. One of the students present when Franz Brentano was lecturing so brilliantly was Richard Wahle. Richard Wahle wrote a book in 1894 which was much more significant than is usually assumed among philosophers, titled The Whole of Philosophy and Its End, Its Legacy for Theology, Physiology, Aesthetics, and Public Education. If we want to look impartially at the development of intellectual life, then we have to point out the importance of this book. I just want to characterize how Richard Wahle viewed the world. With this view had developed out of what was undoubtedly the enormous inspiration Richard Wahle had received from Franz Brentano, and also out of what was otherwise available in the intellectual culture of the time. Richard Wahle said, "Our experience of the world, what is it exactly?" Now, our experience of the world is that, in quotes, events appear before us. Here I stand. In front of my eyes there appear walls, brightness, lamps, people. I have to make these events into my own personal experiences by means of my own ideas. Everywhere are events that become my own through ideas. All I have within myself are concepts of events. The world is a sum of events represented to me by my ideas. But let us take an impartial look at what we have here. Do we ever really have a table before us? We have an event, an occurrence, that is represented to us through the concept of the table. Do we have a human being before us? Again, we have an event represented by the concept of a human being. All we have are representations of events. It is ingenious when someone so under the influence of Franz Brentano could see how he cancelled the will and only accepted the life of concepts and at the most of feelings, as I said yesterday. This life of ideas only allows for subjective representations of events. And what are these events? They are anodyne, completely anodyne. For if I have an event, I will use a drastic example here, in which someone slaps someone else's face, this is an event or a series of events, but I do not know what is behind it all. Richard Wahle says quite rightly, we only have events represented by subjective ideas. We cannot reach the determinants behind it. He freely admits that hidden behind what we have as human beings are determining factors, but we are unable to reach them. Therefore, we can only become agnostics. We have to confess that when one person hits another in the face, then my idea of the moving fist is feeble, without strength, and does not connect powerfully with the face of the other person. I only have the idea of it. This is how Wahle dissolves all that is accessible to us humans into subjective representations of events. Even what we perceive inside ourselves are events, just that they surface from inside instead of being occurrences outside ourselves. Again, we know nothing of the determining factors inside ourselves. We have not even an idea of the determining factors behind the event, when, because of my thinking, which is powerless and unable to slap anyone around the face, my hand lifts up to do exactly that. What factors are at work here, we do not know. What is at work in us, we do not know. However, we cannot possibly concede that the mere thought hits the other person in the face. Thoughts are powerless, and even if we turn to the great heroes of history, they only exist as subjective ideas. Think, for example, of Bismarck. He only exists as a subjective representative of events. The content of his soul life, or that of the great heroes, has not done these great deeds. The deeds happened through the determining factors, which we humans are unable to reach. With Brentano, you see someone struggling to get away from a worldview that still tries for reality, but is based on belief in revelation, and into a pure intellectualism in the life of ideas, where he gets stuck, so that he cannot even continue to write his title, Psychology, beyond the first volume. And you see how Richard Wahle, coming from the same contemporary trend, felt obligated to stick to anodyne concepts, the content of the intellect. It all becomes feeble, powerless. The human being cultivates only intellectual ideas, and finally sees how feeble they are. It was an important experience when, after my first lecture in Vienna, Richard Wahle said to me, "I do have my ideas about the determining factors, but basically, in comparison with the ancient philosophers, we are just grave diggers." In Richard Wahle, we find something quite harrowing. He was condemned to admitting, in the most brilliant manner, that what human beings can obtain for their souls from this new culture is but feeble and powerless. I briefly mentioned to him the names of people who were teaching in Vienna when Valla was still a student, Zimmermann, Franz Brentano. He responded, yes, they still dared to make arguments. We do not dare do even that anymore. And just look at the book that appeared in 1894, titled The Whole of Philosophy and Its End, Its Legacy for Theology, Physiology, Aesthetics, and Public Education. Theology. Does this mean we should take up theology as it was taught before? Should we completely give up trying to reach the supersensible? Should we just go back to what Brentano had to abandon with such consequences? What kind of process is it that takes what philosophy could once offer us and gives it back as a legacy to theology again, at least in part? How should what philosophy once offered become a legacy to physiology? Just think, physiology in the sense of Adolf Fick leads us to the act of creation by God at the beginning of time. This legacy would not be able to give us anything satisfactory. And according to the demands of science at the time, aesthetics would not be acceptable as a way of discovering truth. And public education, now it is quite understandable that someone who is unable to establish a relationship to the spiritual world should turn to ideas conceived of by human beings within human society, so that what determines our actions should be incorporated into public education in the broadest sense. Thus, whatever leads to action by a human being, whether child or adult, should be determined by the laws of the state. A certain orientation should be provided by the laws of the state. So we see that in his book, titled The Whole of Philosophy and Its End, agnosticism blossoms most ingeniously, most vigorously, and most conscientiously. And how could it have been any different? I will express what I have to say here in an image. Philosophy is love of wisdom. We can only love what we know to be alive. As long as Sophia was seen as something living, we could speak of philosophia. Nowadays, when Sophia is just an aggregate of all sorts of ideas about the lifeless, gathered together from all over the place, now philo also has to wither away. Essentially, this revolutionary, Richard Valla, took the argument on a philosophical level to its logical conclusion. He simply stated what had become of philosophy under the influence of the intellect alone. This we cannot love. It has to fall apart into indifferent fragments. This is how it must end. After the death of Sophia, there can be no love left for her, or at most in memoriam. Thus philosophy has become a dead subject. We could honor its memory. And of course we could still write a history of philosophy. We could also resurrect old systems. This is basically what the new philosophers have most often done. We have had neo-Kantians, neo-Fichtians, Haeckelians, whatever commemorates our adoration of a deceased lover. And if we look at the insipid, subjective representations of events, which are just intellectualistic notions, then we can understand the whole process. Then we also understand the fact that philosophical thinking has reached its end, that it had to reach its end. This is why in my title, Riddles of Philosophy, after I have depicted the whole course of philosophy, from the ancient Greek philosophers up to the second half of the 19th century, I attempt to show that what was philosophy had to be transformed into anthroposophy. Hence the last chapter is a schematic description of anthroposophy. That we have to proceed in this way, that we have to see anthroposophy as the last chapter of philosophy, is not the result of subjective considerations, but of the objective course of historical development itself. And it is precisely by looking at those personalities who are most typical of modern times that we are compelled to see things this way. For as humanity has arrived at these insipid ideas that no longer contain any reality, after humanity has forgotten that these concepts are just the corpses of what was once life before we descended from the spiritual worlds into earthly existence, now it is necessary that we revitalize these ideas through the methods found in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? Through meditation, through concentration. And we are faced with the task not of just stopping at the ideas of science, like Franz Brentano, but of absorbing and revitalizing them through inner spiritual work consisting of meditation and concentration. Then the most modern scientific ideas will lead us directly to the supersensible world. Then they will lead to the development of that method which is the method of anthroposophy. Then the method of anthroposophy develops out of natural science. This can then fill the wishy-washy representations of events with life again, with vitality. Because for a humanity that has advanced as far as the intellect, this life, this vitality, has to originate in the intellect itself. And I want to say that in relation to the more intimate aspect of this problem, Franz Brentano seems to me, again, especially typical. As a quite young man, he wrote a letter to an acquaintance about meditation, for he was attached to the meditation he had been taught in Catholicism, which, however, never led him to the independent development of an inner spiritual life. Franz Brentano wrote approximately this about the meditation he had learned. "I do advise you not to stop meditation. Someone who lives only a life of action, with no contemplative, no meditative life, they are only living a quarter of life. We must live three quarters of life in meditative contemplation. All that brings us closer to God can only come from meditative contemplation." Then he closes with the characteristic sentence, "I would rather die than give up meditation." However, this was a meditation taught in the ancient life of the spirit. And here we can sense the tragedy of someone who loves meditation, but because they are bound by scientific bonds, they cannot develop further into a free meditation that leads them to a new understanding of the spiritual, the supersensible life. Perhaps it is this letter that shows us how Franz Brentano was led by inner necessity to the gates of anthroposophy, but could not open them, because he had to repudiate all that he believed must be rejected by the scientific ethos and way of thinking. It is a simple fact that science has certain limitations. If science does not just say there is nothing more to achieve, but following Adolf Fick, Franz Brentano's university colleague, says there is a creative act of God, an act of creation, then we can also say that just as it is legitimate to consider the whole field of the physical, so we must consider this aspect too. The physical does not only set limitations, it also points to the fact that there is something which must also be considered positively. It is truly not an arbitrary subjectivity. When we point these things out, when we point out how necessary anthroposophy is for universal human culture, on the contrary, whoever considers the history of intellectual life impartially will see from that the necessity for anthroposophy. Let us assume anthroposophy was recognized as a scientific approach. Then it would be easy for someone like Adolf Fick to teach the following. Physical research goes only so far. For the rest, it has nothing to say. But there is a continuation, and that is anthroposophic research. However, what from the physical point of view is the end of the world, something like the heat death, will only be seen in its proper light when all of evolution is seen according to what I have described in my book titled Occult Science and Outline, where Saturn existence leads us back to the beginnings, where we have nature consisting only of warmth, and then at the end, Vulcan existence consisting also of warmth. Not only at the beginning and at the end will we see the creative spiritual act, but during the whole of evolution, the physical will always be seen in connection with the spiritual powers and spiritual deeds of spiritual beings, who do not go through a physical incarnation. So that, of course, the anthroposophical and the physical are not just next to each other, but the one permeates the other. When we consider individual physical facts, we will hear much about how spiritual forces work in physical sensual existence. Then nobody will speak of events and undetermined factors. Rather, they will speak of how, in what occurs as events, we can find those hitherto unknown factors at the end and at the beginning of evolution, and throughout the whole unfolding of evolution as well. I would like to make this clear using an image. Assume that you have a mirror, and you see in it what I have described. We can stay with this symbolic image, even if it is rather drastic. You see in the mirror what I described. Someone slaps someone else's face. In the mirror image, you have the whole process. There you have images, and you can certainly not say that the one image is so powerful that it slaps the other in the face. However, this is just how the modern philosopher thinks about his ideas. They are as powerless as images in a mirror. The one mirror image cannot slap the other in the face. But the philosopher Richard Valla, for example, goes on brilliantly. He says, "We cannot get to the determining factors. Even if right in front of me I have two people where the one slaps the other's face, I still only have the idea of it, and the idea of person A cannot slap person B in the face. And I cannot get to the determining factors that are really giving the slap." This image is quite a good symbol. The mirror image of person A cannot give the mirror image of person B a slap. However, if you look carefully at the mirror images, you will see all sorts of movement patterns. But you will not believe that the slap has really hurt the mirror image of person B. You will not feel sorry for the mirror image for having been slapped like that. And if you look more closely, look at the face of the mirror image after they have been slapped, then you will find something in this face that would be inexplicable if it was just an insipid image. In other words, philosophy had come to a standstill with Richard Valla, when there was only talk of events, but no possibility of reading these events, since all the atavistic clairvoyance, which alone would have made such reading possible, had been lost. You can read in the image of the person who was slapped, in the expression of the face, that all this points to determining factors. If you open a book, then you can read in it, if you have learned to do so, and you will not say, "Here I cannot see the determining factors." This is because what you are reading leads you to a certain understanding of these factors. We have to learn again to read the phenomena, the manifestations. We can easily acknowledge that in the intellectual age there are only representations of events, but if we are able to go to work on these subjective representations with inner fortitude, then we will learn to read them. Then we will become not Kantians, but anthroposophists, who say, "Of course, from the ideas that we have, we can know nothing of the determining factors. But if we understand how to read the world, then we will gradually learn how, through reading the events, we can attain knowledge of these factors." This can only happen, however, when we bring strength into our inner life. And we can only achieve this through those methods given for meditation, concentration, and so on. Thus we can say that modern philosophy has dried out, squeezed out of itself, all that is life-giving for intellectual life. This was due to human beings who could not find the way into the supersensible worlds, and also due to the times in which they lived. So we must now learn how to strive for inner development, so that we can find again the way into the supersensible worlds. This was what I wanted to put before you, through this quite detailed historical description of the second half of the 19th century. I also wanted to lay the groundwork here for some of what I will speak about in the next few lectures. The end of Lecture 8.